Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Mike Brown, Dark Poutine himself, is here.
Back again. Yes.
Back again.
Boy, I'm like a bad rash. I keep turning up when you least expect me.
Yeah, we need to get a cure for this.
Yes.
You know, we've got a couple of doctors here, but I don't think they're the right kind.
No.
For a rash.
But I think we'll be okay, but yeah.
They probably have good advice how to get rid of my rash. Well, okay. So let's see. Let's start with our guests today. So first up, we've got Dr. Anne Burgess. And of course, a lot of people know Anne from being played in the show of Mindhunters on Netflix. And of course, she's got a couple of good books out. And her latest book is A Killer by Design. And so welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
And of course, we've got Dr. Gary Brucato. And everyone knows him from his book, A New Evil. And one of the best resources for people in true crime and serial killers for years. So thank you, Gary, for being here.
Oh, of course. Pleasure.
Well, guys, it never continues, or never stops, I should say. You know, there's always a constant murder in the news, or two or several, mm-hmm. and there's always a constant mass murder and or shootings in workplaces and stuff like that. And it seems to continue. I mean, it's been a couple of years since we've had you on, but the same thing was going on back then as going on now. And it seems to be highlighted, or certainly a lot more in the U.S. than anywhere in the world. I just wonder what your thoughts on that, and if things are is there hope for things to get better for us? And let's start with Anne.
Well, I think one of the things that is, when you're talking about statistics and things like that, the 80s were an important time when the FBI were really tasked with going after serial killers, and that's one of the reasons that they put an emphasis on that. So we see an increase there. And I think that what's important is Gary's work on, well, what might be the reason for that? And his book really goes into the culture and things like that might be responsible for increasing it. But certainly the fact that there was an increase and that we were never sure whether it was just an increase or whether the police were getting better at catching the serial killers, or if this new phenomenon of profiling was going to help.
And Gary, so what are your thoughts? Like, do you think things are getting better in that way, or is there some underlying condition that's going on in the human race that we're just going to keep on doing this?
Well, first of all, the question you're asking is right at the heart of the book I did, and it's also right at the heart of why it is that Anne was invited by the FBI to kind of become involved in helping to understand sexual assault, sexual offenses, serial killing involving that kind of offense, you know, in the 1970s, 1980s. The thing is, when people are interested in true crime or criminology or study it professionally, they start to realize that the notion that these offenses, like you see today, have basically been happening at the same rate across all of history, it rapidly emerges as a myth. What really happened is that there was a kind of a gradual ingress, smattering of those things throughout history. You could count on a couple of hands, let's say sexually motivated serial killers prior to the 1960s. And then all of a sudden, there's a huge explosion of them, particularly in the Western world, that goes from the 60s to the 90s. And there's been a huge question about why that was, why the FBI suddenly needed to become interested in it and invited people like Anne to look at it. And, you know, so what I think is the answer lies in the at the intersection of technology and changes in the culture. And what happens is that as culture progresses and certain kind of, you know, and let me be clear, this is not an endorsement for any particular religious or cultural belief. It's just that those things serve as a kind of glue and give people a sense of identity and boundaries. And as time progresses and those things are kind of gradually worn out, worn away, what you start to see is a kind of gradual disinhibiting of people who lack any clear sense of identity or purpose, a kind of existential soup. And when you take that and you place it alongside changes in technology, you start to see that the law enforcement is constantly having to outpace changes that occur technologically. So, for example, as soon as something is invented, whether it's the internet, social media, et cetera, it's immediately used for crime. Anne and I, for example, have recently been consulted on crime related to the metaverse, which is, you know, now that the metaverse is being designed, immediately you start to see assault of people in the metaverse, sexual assault especially, that kind of thing. You know, as a simple example is the moment the microwave was invented, it was used on three occasions to kill infants. So this is a strange quality of human beings that we take technology, use it in that way, and then law enforcement has to outpace it. Certainly, we could talk a little bit about DNA technology and things like that that have reduced the number of serial killers, probably because their people are getting caught before they offend multiple times. But it may also be that there's a cultural change because in the 1990s, late 1990s and early 2000s, there was a transition to more mass murder and a reduction in serial killing. So, but I think we really have to ask some very hard questions about the effects of cultural changes on changing the personality structure of the average individual.
Yeah, but when we look at things like that, is it really the nature of the crime that changes? And I mean this in the sense of a lot of people around in the 60s and 70s, when let's say religion had a lot bigger influence, was more common in the household, we also produced a lot of serial killers that isn't so much now. So it's also kind of, I don't know, I'm not sure how to take that.
Well, that's considered the kind of demarcation point where you start to see the change in the way that crime presents statistically in the United States. It's a turning point in criminological history. One theory that's been proposed, we talk about it in the New Evil, is that the very good freedoms that women obtained in the 1960s onward led to a kind of backlash on the part of certain men who had a very hard time tolerating the loss of control over women that they had culturally. And that could be expressed in anything from serial sexual homicide to the things we see in the Me Too movement. and certain atrocities toward women that we see to this day that did explode in the wake of the sexual revolution. It's interesting to think about if that's a coincidence. Right. Go ahead. And this would be a great point for Anne, I think, to come in and talk about, because she came right in at that point.
Right. Yeah. Well, the one thing I want to say from a cultural standpoint is the 60s and the 70s really was when the women's movement started, the second women's movement, if you will. And there was a great push by women to get together to talk in what they called consciousness raising groups. And they talked about things that they had never talked about before, which of course had a lot to do with sex and sexual assault, incest, rape. And it was very empowering to these women who never were really out of the house very much before that, because you didn't have women, at least in those days, that had a two-career family that would, as Linda Holmstrom had studied, they would be in the home. The husband would be making the money and going to work. And so when that started to change, the issue and talking about these the sexual issues that women had, that's when the rape really started to come about. I think there was one other case that really captured people. It was back in the 60s, and it was the Kitty Genovese case. And this was a case where supposedly people watched while this young woman who was screaming and yelling, and he was attempting to rape her, and ultimately did not only rape her but killed her. And people watch, it was called the bystander inertia. They didn't do anything. And then there was a lot of misinformation was given that on that case. And when they went back and really looked at it, they found out that people, not everybody had heard about it and failed to call police or anything. But the other important thing out of that case is that was the genesis of 911 call. Because in those days, you had to, I think, just dial operator, take a while, the operator would come on, and it would take a long time for anyone to respond to whatever the crisis or the urgency was. So I would think those two issues were really, really important of the women now finding their voice and starting to weigh in, if you will, on some of the cultural issues that they were having difficulty with.
Right. And it's very important that we emphasize, because this issue comes up, that this, none of this should be interpreted as to suggest that there's like a blaming of the of women for their freedoms being responsible for these changes. It's more that men, certain men, brittle men, reacted negatively to them. And the other thing that I think is essential to get into, and this is where Anne really contributed to the literature, and you can read all about it in The Killer by Design, is that when Anne was advising the FBI on how to question serial killers and other offenders, it started to emerge that these offenders almost invariably came from certain backgrounds that preceded this kind of killing, like broken homes and, you know, drinking and violence in their background and unstable parents. So that starts to raise questions also about how the culture affected these men as children. And, you know, really important questions about broken homes and abuse and violence and things that were going on. And, you know, there are very few exceptions. I mean, you could look at people like the BTK killer or Ted Bundy, and certain people that arguably did not have those kinds of backgrounds, but very few of them don't, which I think is something we also have to think about, the intersection of what they experienced and their particular probably biology coming together to become these kind of master predators.
Right, and it was even the way they were portrayed, and I think this is where Gary's book really, really tries to get into it. They were portrayed as it was the mother. And when there was a split in the family, it was the mother. It was the bad mother or the controlling mother or whatever. Well, we found it was the absent father that was really, really important, that these men, at least the 36 that we studied, grew up with many of them without a strong or even a male in the home. So the mother was left to raise the children. And that's been a very important factor, I think, in understanding the development, the child developing into the adolescent.
Absolutely. We certainly see that in cases in which Anne was heavily involved. Simple examples being Edmund Kemper, where the father was absent, Henry Wallace, the Taco Bell strangler, whose mother essentially blamed him for the mother abandoning the family and assaulted him, you know. So, I mean, there you can read about a lot of cases where that point is extremely relevant in both of our books.
But what distinguishes it in the sense of those that don't have, you know, the need to go out and kill or that fantasy and stuff, yet they were brought up in a real abusive neighborhood, or they didn't have a father and things like that. But you know, and still they come up pretty productive and normal, as I guess was what we would say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's a development of a fantasy that of the death fantasy, if you want to talk about murder. That is something that started early. And in the cases you just said, when there is no fantasy, you don't see that necessarily being that. That's why they don't turn that way. They get into something else. They can be very productive. We've seen cases where you could have someone be very, very, very lethal, if you will, but have a siblings that didn't get into crime at all. I'm Gary has seen that too. That, how do you explain that? You know, there's, even though they grow up in the same, if you will, environment, one turns out, one goes one road and one goes the other.
I think it has a lot to do with personality configuration. I think that, you know, when we look at people, especially if we're talking about serial killers, particularly of the sexually sadistic type, almost invariably there's some type of psychopathy that is present, narcissism, psychopathy, and sadism as a kind of soup in those people. And when we look at that condition, when we look at this type of person, what probably goes on based on the available literature, although it's kind of hard to go out there and do brain scans of, you know, sexually sadistic people in prison. But what we have learned is that probably there's certain brain abnormalities in these individuals. Very specific areas of the brain have been identified that are a little absent or kind of reduced in size or activity level in these people. And what seems to happen is that if you have that type of brain and you've got that kind of psychopathic personality, you have traits like being sensation seeking, easily bored, unafraid, highly extroverted, charming, etc. And if you were raised in a positive environment, those things could be used in a pro-social way, like being the person that would throw yourself on a grenade to save your friends or work perhaps in you know, for the military or law enforcement. Not to suggest, of course, that people who are in those fields have psychopathic brains. It's more that there may be a smattering of people who are drawn to that kind of thing. But then what happens is, because of the poor treatment that some of these people receive, that those traits are then applied in an antisocial way. And what you see in a lot of these people, Ed Kemper, who was mentioned being a good example, is that there are times in their life where they actually were considering moving in the direction of working for law enforcement, or in the case of Henry Wallace, who was mentioned, he was an excellent Navy officer. That there's an attraction to that because it lends structure and identity to a purpose, that a person that's kind of swimming in confusion and has those traits. And what happens is, and has really contributed to this, what is now, I think, kind of household knowledge on serial killers' development, is that what you see is that from the time they're children, they have very specific kind of fantasies, very visual, intense fantasies of leveling the playing field and getting even with the people that have hurt them. And then at some point, usually in adolescence or young adulthood, there's a tipping point, sometimes caused by a life event that makes them feel out of control, where they finally go out and enact it, and then need to keep doing it to perfect the fantasy, or because they're getting increasingly disinhibited, or it's like a drug where they just keep wanting to up the dosage. And, you know, so that I think it all starts with that brain and that personality style and the question of, are you treated well or not? And that's where I think the cultural changes come in. There probably were people with predatory kind of psychopathic brains all across history, but you need the intersection with something that disinhibits you or makes you angry.
Sensational thinking, like when they're seeking that usually is, you know, caused by a large ego, a person that thinks of themselves as not you know, being caught or anything. I automatically think of the accused killer of the Idaho Four when I come to that. Someone that's gained attention yet was so worried about the attention, they weren't really careful.
Right.
Right.
Well, Ann and I could talk quite a bit about this case. We profiled it.
Yeah, let's. Yeah, I'm curious about it for sure. I mean, this guy was even a student of Catherine Ramsland's, which is really fascinating, you know, a student of this kind of crime. So let's go for it. I'm really, really interested.
Well, the way we started, Gary and I, when we would get together and talk about it, is don't forget we didn't, from my standpoint, we didn't have the crime scene. We didn't have anything that went on in the house. We only had what information we could get from driving around the house or seeing the house or the location of the house, and as little bits and pieces would come out to talk on that. But I think Gary can certainly, he certainly had the personality structure down. And we did one other interesting thing I think I could tell him, Gary, is we know a journalist that's following Ed Kemper. And we know that we thought what Ed Kemper would think, and this is all before they identified any suspect. And when we took pictures of the layout for the journalist to take in, because he met with them in person, he meets with them, I think, routinely. And he put the pictures down. The first thing Ed Kemper said, he pointed to the cars, and he wanted to know who the cars belonged to. And, of course, one of the big factors is that white car. So I just was amazed at that right off the bat he would pick up on something like that. But then cars are often the one of the lead points that you can get. But Gary could talk a little bit about how he came up with some of that personality structure.
Well, the major clue in this situation was that it was a mass murder. You know, there were four people killed at the same time in the same location, which according to any definition, there are a few, is a mass murder. Now, when I was at Columbia Medical Center, my colleague, Raggy Gerges, and I created the Columbia Mass Murder Database. That's the largest study ever done of mass murder for 1900 to 2019, mass shootings and any other kind of mass murder. And it became clear to me, based on the statistics from that database, that the key to this whole thing was that it was perpetrated with a knife. Because what we know is that when any weapon is used in a mass murder other than a gun, we're looking at a much higher likelihood that the perpetrator would be somebody who had some authentic psychiatric difficulty and probably would be considered odd to other people. And so immediately, part of the profile for me was that this was a person where stories would emerge about a kind of weird, hot-headed, paranoid, interpersonally poor individual, an inadequate personality who was probably expressing some kind of anger or misogyny or something else through these killings. And also noteworthy for me and Ann was that there was no sexual, at least overt, sexual component, no rape, no semen at the scene that we know of, nothing like that. And when you look at offenders where there is no sexual component who do something like this, what you start looking at is offenders previously who have done similar things. And ego-driven offenders like this, and I think, Ann, you would agree, this is the person who committed this offense has the makings of a serial killer.
Yes.
Not a mass murderer. A mass murderer is generally sated or commits suicide after the mass murder because it's not really about being a psychopath. It's about exploding because of something immediate at the time, the loss of something, losing a job, school, whatever. That's very clear. A serial killer is much more likely to be a psychopath, where the whole point is this was my first try to fulfill a fantasy, and now I'm going to keep going out and topping it or doing it more and more. And this looks more like that. So we also postulated somebody that chose a knife because of its power, its possible sexual symbolism, its cruelty, probably enjoying the intimacy with the victim, being covered in blood, probably being part of the thrill. And so we kind of put all of that together, and we also postulated as someone who stalked the victims for some time, who was comfortable with the layout of the house. We felt that the person had probably been there or at least looked at the house a great deal beforehand, and also envisioned somebody who went in dressed for the occasion like it was some kind of mission, you know, probably with a headlight to kill in the dark, probably with a, you know, a knife sheath, I think I had said in the profile. And of course, he wound up leaving a sheath at the scene. And so the final thing I'll say that Ann and I both agreed was very important in the profile was the commission of the crime when they were asleep and in the dark. And we thought that that was a clue of a deeply kind of insecure, control-oriented person who probably didn't like the idea that if someone saw him with their eyes when they were awake and less vulnerable, that they wouldn't necessarily be afraid of him or think he was powerful. And you see that with the serial killer Robert Hansen, who was also studied by the FBI, profiled by, I think, John Douglas. He was a very small, inadequate person living in Alaska who would pick up prostitutes and hunt them in the forest with a gun from behind. And it was noticed that they were always shot in the back. And John Douglas's point was he probably was doing this in the dark, you know, shooting them in the back, because if they turned around and saw him, they would see that he was a little inadequate person. And when they were not seeing him, he could fantasize that he was very powerful. So we thought that figured into this person also. And then when the person, Koberger, was identified as a suspect, even though, of course, he remains a suspect, I think we were pretty impressed by how much the profile matched the suspect, especially as stories emerged about him being an inadequate, angry, kind of brittle guy who was constantly weirding people out socially and seemed to have a need for power and control over other people. And consistent with a lot of Ann's work, what it's starting to look like is that he may have been disinhibited by the loss of a job and then expressed hostility afterward towards someone that had been stalked. Anne, anything to add to that? I think that pretty much.
Right. We certainly felt, I felt just initially as the case was presented was a, what we call a blitz style approach out of the, no prior interaction, just comes in and that he did it at night. All of what you said was important. I found it, and that he, there are a couple of unusual features to it, that there was a male involved and then the three women, that I think we agreed that that was a surprise, that he was targeting someone going in, that he certainly knew the house, had to have known the house to get around it without any lights on it. Nobody ever reported that lights had been on, and that there were two women down in the first floor or the lower floor, and they were not, as far as we know, they one saw him. But we didn't know that, certainly at the time we were trying to do the profile.
That a male was involved really, for me, stood out, reminded me of the Gainesville Ripper, Danny Rowling. And it was sort of reminiscent of that in a way. Am I wrong in that comparison? Or is there, you know, like you say, you compare these crimes to ones that are have already been committed and, you know, sussed out and all that.
Well, you always get the possibility that there are some to actually follow through with the mission, whatever the mission is of the fantasy, that there's going to be some problems. And I think that's, I don't know that, I think Gary knows that case better than I do, but that there was a male makes it more difficult for the shooter or the stabber, I guess, in this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Kids, it's a stabber, but that could have thrown him off. There were several things that could have thrown him off. Did he really know that there were six people in and all of this, I think, will be coming out hopefully at the trial or in June, whenever they have a hearing. But there are still some very interesting questions that we have that would, how much can be like other cases, like you suggest, are always as where you always try to match with a case that you've heard about before. That's why New Evil is such an important book, because it has, where would you place him on that scale, Gary?
Well, the maximum score that someone can receive in that book, who has not committed sexual assault or repeat murder, is 16, which is the category for people who have committed extreme violent and atrocious violent crimes, including murder, where there is no sexual assault and no torture. And fascinatingly, when you look at people who fall into that category, who do not express power, domination, and control over people through sexual, at least overt sexual means, because you could argue that the knife was quasi-sexual, what you start to see is patterns in common. Other people that fall into Category 16 would be the Zodiac Killer, the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, and the Son of Sam, David Berkowitz. Now, what do all three of those people have in common? All three of them, because they were intensely ego-driven and expressed domination and control through their words and, you know, the writing to the press, writing to police, etc. What you start to imagine is that if Koberger is the killer, that probably we would increasingly find that all over the place he was writing and talking. because people like that love the attention that comes from asserting control over the public by manipulating the narrative. And indeed, we predicted that would happen, and we started to see over time after Koberger was identified that he did mountains of writing and seemed to be toying with the narrative and probably, you know, intentionally throwing red herrings out there. And that ego trip for people in that category is the key to the whole thing, because it's almost invariably how they get tripped up. And so we had also predicted that this is somebody whose desire for control and so forth, that ultimately it was going to trip him up, that he might have, let's say, some unconscious desire to get caught, to get attention, or make some stupid mistake where he overestimated his ego, his power over the scene or ability to control that many people. The case that is most often compared, although Rowling is interesting because of the targeting of students, and of course Bundy attempted a mass murder at the sorority house in Florida, but not enough people died to fall into the mass murder designation. But the case that's most often compared is, for whatever reason, is the BTK case, the Dennis Rader case. The reason being that if Koberger is the killer, he turned 28 just after the murders, and Dennis Rader was 28 at the time of his offense. Rader was triggered by the loss of a job. That's the speculation with Koberger also. And both of them were not sexual in their offenses, and their first offenses would be breaking into a home and committing a mass murder. And so, you know, there's also a comparison made because both seem to be of the obsessional, mechanical type, the kind of people that when people interacted with them would find not particularly nice and warm and cuddly, and the kind of people that would have an explosive temper. So, and that is something that's been talked about a great deal because of the fascinating coincidence that Koberger's instructor was Dr. Ramslin, who was the foremost authority on BTK, and his biographer. But it looks, at least at this time, that that's just a kind of a strange coincidence. It does raise the question of whether Koberger became fascinated with BTK. And people began to wonder if they were corresponding. Anne and I have done several appearances on podcasts and shows with Carrie Rawson, the daughter of BTK. And she has looked into this and has, you know, and as has TMZ. And it looks like there was no connection between the two of them in terms of contact. So it raises some interesting questions. But I think, Anne, you would agree there are some pretty interesting parallels between those two.
Oh, absolutely. And one wonders, you know, the theory is, or the speculation is, and maybe it has been proven, I'm not sure that Carrie would know this, that his that length of time that he doesn't, as far as we know, commit any kinds of crimes, that he's engaged in autoerotic activity, which makes me wonder if there's a parallel with the suspect they have, because he certainly doesn't come up with any partner that we have heard of since he's been identified as a suspect. So I think we're going to learn a lot more interesting things. I can't wait for June to see what we can find out, and especially who the experts are going to be that will be testifying.
Well, because, and I think this, you know, Anne is really, what she's referring to a little bit here is that, you know, we think of these offenders, the people of this type, as not being overtly sexual. But when you go in there and you get to know those offenders, they do have a perverse sexual life that's more private. For example, it emerged that David Berkowitz was gaining sexual pleasure by setting fires and watching the police descend upon the fire. That was sexually arousing to him because it was about power and the ability to control people of authority. And so that I think one of the things Anne is suggesting, and I agree, is that it's going to be pretty fascinating to find out what was going on in the private fantasy life of whoever committed those Idaho murders. And I personally would imagine that there'd be an interesting search history on the internet, probably some pornography related to domination and control, and that kind of thing, because it's almost invariably present in that type of offender.
Yeah, we would want to know what pornography he did use. That will be very important. And as Gary says, you can get that from his laptop, hopefully, if they were able to access it. But the other thing is didn't seem as though might not be. I would just, that he doesn't tie his victims up. That's always tied in. Don't mean that as a pun, but that's a important thing. Didn't BTK tie up?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And bags on the heads. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So that might be a difference, because this was the Idaho case involved somebody going in very quickly in a blitz type attack and stabbing. I can't emphasize enough that Gary's point about the use of a weapon. That's always very important. And anytime you're trying to profile a case, is what was the weapon used? Because that could be very, very telling.
Right. I mean, a BTK spent probably more time with his victims, presumably, than this guy did. Like you say, they weren't tied up. It was a blitz attack. It's really fascinating. I mean, I do true crime for a living, so always there's a comparison. I hate to say it that way, and also not in a punny way, but it's always interesting to compare these things, because there are patterns through. I mean, human beings are pattern creatures, and it's really important, the work that you folks do, to identify these patterns, I believe.
The victim selection, then, is it important who the victim is to a killer like this Idaho 4 killer? Because, of course, you know, he's been arrested. But so is it really important? Does he need to know them very well, or is it just more about the situation?
Well, he fantasizes. He can build the fantasy as he wants, especially if he has seen them, which we strongly suspect happened, that he can follow them. He can get really into his fantasy. So in a way, he doesn't need to know them. Maybe he would like to know them. I do think that there's, and Gary would know this, didn't something come out about his trying to text one of the...
Yeah, on Instagram, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. So you're going to learn a lot more if there's an analysis of the text messaging.
Right. Well, I think an important thing to mention here is that, you know, when you're dealing with people with this, at least assumed kind of personality structure, the key is that the victim in many ways is a proxy or a stand-in for some fantasy or person that has upset you from the past, so that you don't need very much contact with the individual to develop a very profound fantasy about them. As a matter of fact, in serial killers, there is often, especially sexually sadistic ones, there's almost a desire to know as little as possible about the personal traits of the person that you pick up or so forth, because it kills the fantasy. So like Ted Bundy, for example, didn't want to know things about you. If he picked you up and you started to talk about, you know, I've got to study for a test the next day or something like that, it would bother him, because he needed you to be a blank slate. He only cared about your appearance, because you were being cast in a fantasy like a movie director would do. And anything you bring in from your personal life is not of interest. In fact, it can be a buzzkill for that kind of personality. So that I think what you want to understand, if Koberger is the killer, probably what was going on was that he had a longstanding kind of anger at women, particularly women he considered attractive, for feeling kind of like he couldn't dominate them or control them. Here's the cultural piece we talked about earlier, right? Because in the 1930s, he would have been able to find a partner, or the 1940s or something. It was a lot harder in the post-1960s world. And I think he didn't know how to navigate it or negotiate it. I think he tried everything in the book to figure out how to turn people into a science, how to understand, to mimic ordinary conversation and so forth. But he was just too weird, interpersonally and off-putting. And I think his final conclusion was, I'm just going to assert control violently. And my guess is he saw one of the victims and became fixated on her as symbolic of all of the kinds of women who have rejected him. And unfortunately, everybody else was like collateral damage. I can't help but believe, for example, that the male victim was just in the wrong place at the wrong time with his girlfriend. I don't believe that they were the target. So, I mean, Anne, wouldn't you echo that?
Oh, I would agree with that. The alternative would be that he saw it as a challenge, and he was going to, here's a guy that could get this very beautiful young woman, and, fighting off and being victorious in that. I mean, that could be the fantasy. I have no idea, but I think either one is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point.
But for him to get the young girl, what does that mean? It's just control, but it's just killing her.
Right.
So there's not, it's not about trying to force her into a relationship or make her something to him other than what's in his mind.
Yeah, but as Gary says, though, it's the hated person, whoever, and you're going to have to find out there's something goes on, what women would do.
Mm-hmm.
And so he still is doing what the goal is. I'm going to rid, that's your misogynist type. And if you ever go online and read some of these misogynist types, these incels, which some possibility he could have features of that. It's incredible how angry and they are at women and how women have all the power and the control and they can. So I think that is what one of the things we've talked about in terms of some personality structure. Gary can speak better to that about how that works. But look at what we hear about his as a TA. In the course, and it's, I really want to know what the altercation, I think was the word, correct me if I'm wrong, that he had with the teacher, with the instructor, and that he couldn't correct his behavior. And that speaks to, he was going to get his way or not. He even got his way, if you will, in a very counterintuitive way with that getting fired. I mean, that's pretty hard to be fired as a TA. You know, it really took work.
Right. Well, it's interesting because when you get in there and really kind of talk to these offenders in a really perverse, strange way, what some of them talk about is the idea of rendering the symbolic victim that's being murdered over and over again through these repeat victims. It's like to render them permanent and predictable because they come from unstable parents, a lot of them. So it's like a weird way of like, now you are part of me forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have you completely under control. So that in some of them, this is literally true. Like when Dahmer, when he would eat a victim, when he was interviewed, he spoke quite clearly about that his original trigger was not wanting his first victim to leave him. So that it was a way of rendering him a permanent object forever. And a lot of cannibals talk about that, that the motivation was to have someone that now forever is yours. And you always know where they are, right? That kind of thing.
Right.
So I think that in a really weird way, what some of them are craving is a kind of a secure attachment that they want control over something that's theirs forever. And you see that also in acts of necrophilia, and you see it in acts of keeping trophies and objects from people and everything else. But I think that's a big part of it, of the psychology of it. So it's like, I don't care about talking to you. I just want to know I've collected you, and now you're with me always. And it's very strange. It reminds me of a patients I have who are obsessionally interested in something that they don't actually use. Like, for example, I have a patient who collects mementos related to all kinds of famous musicians, but he never actually listens to the music. He just has everything in the world related to them, including, you know, articles of clothing, the original bow used by this person on their violin, you know, whatever. But he doesn't know anything about actually listening to. So I think it's sort of like that, wanting to possess a human being, but not being very interested in people. It's like a weird paradox.
Do you think his ego is what got him caught in this case, or do you think he wanted to get caught?
Well, the latter certainly a lot of people are talking about. But the other thing is, look, he has watched after this. He had a lot of time to watch the newspaper, to watch everybody's anguish. I would think he went to the funeral or the memorial or whatever. I mean, that's what a lot of them do. So he got a lot of vicarious satisfaction, ego, whatever term you'd want at the aftermath It's very unusual to see that much attention put, which is what he wanted, on who did this. What kind of a person could it be? You know, just watch the headlines.
Right. Well, and then, and in the some of the online writing that the suspect did as a teenager, you start to see glimpses of some kind of dissociative thing, whether it was related to drugs or not, where he would kind of stare in the mirror and see meat and have like blips of attention and what we would call a dissociative thing. Interesting that somebody would become a vegan who saw himself and other people turning into meat. And what's interesting about it is that I've wondered if under the intense stress of the moment, he didn't dissociate a little bit or blip out, like have like little micro dissociative things where he made sort of foolish mistakes. You see that in people who have dissociative conditions, although we don't really know anything, you know, in terms of how true that information was, if he actually had a dissociative condition, if it was a psychotic condition, if it was his personality, drugs, we don't know. But it's interesting to think about. But all I know is that irrespective of whatever was going on, this is so meticulously planned out. There is so much malice aforethought that you could not make the argument that he, you know, the person didn't know what they were doing because they were ill or something like that. This is clearly related to the personality.
Right. And it's going to be interesting. I don't know if we'll ever find this out, but anyone interviewing him to find out how much he remembers of the entire, I guess it was only about 20 minutes. I looked at the timeline. I don't know if that's accurate. But how much does he, and did he forget? A lot of I've talked to several murderers who cannot remember the murder, but can remember the dismemberment part. So your point, I think, Gary, is really interesting if we'd ever be able to find out how detailed he could get in his memory.
Right. Well, leaving the sheath is very strange. I mean, that would have been an important souvenir, I would imagine, for this type of person. And the fact that a fingerprint was left on it is also interesting because it leaves me wondering about if he was wearing gloves or wanted to do this with bare hands. Yeah, that's also interesting because we pay attention to things like offenders that don't wear gloves and get in there and strangle or stab with their bare hands because it implies that they don't want anything in the way of the intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to what patients will talk about when you say, why don't you use safe sex? And they say, well, I don't want that rubber layer there. It takes away from the intimacy. It's like I'm not really doing it. And so that use that same kind of thing in a perverse way is there when you have somebody who says, I don't want gloves on when I'm strangling the victim. It takes away from the intimacy. That's the thing. I mean, it's interesting. It's disturbing. But I think we have to go to these dark places to understand the psychology of these people.
Gary, that's a great research question. How many strangulations did they wear gloves? I've never thought of it that way, but you're right.
Yeah, well, that's something Ann and I are studying. Victor Petreka and Ann have a grant just to look at asphyxiation and strangulation murders at Boston College, and I consult on that grant. And maybe that's something we can start to look at.
Well, we looked at ligature versus a manual strangulation and did it make a difference? So what we haven't done is to then take the two groups and maybe look at some other variables. We don't have to get into our research here, but anyway, it is very, very interesting.
I wonder, but why do you think he would block it out, or why do these types of killers block out the murder part but still remember, let's say, dismembering or taking pieces out of the body?
Well, I think you have to look at the physiology of it. I mean, that was an intense, in this particular case, that was an intense four people in a short time would require, so that's what we would talk about before we knew, received a suspect, of how powerful he had to be, how big he had to be, which he was. He was large and strong. And they can get caught up in that. And especially if he had misjudged the situation in any way, that if he, say, for example, he really targeted one and she was up on the top floor. And so he misjudges what floor she's on, or bedroom. And he encounters, I think he encountered the young woman and the male at the first level, and that if he had the targeted one was up above in the next. So think of all that, just being able to think about how this had to have so fast. There could have been enough of, as Gary says, some dissociation, some physiology that in the adrenaline rush. They always talk about the adrenaline rush that they get. They get as much emotion and physiology in just planning the attack. So all of those things kind of come in, and you just ask a wonderful question in terms of trying to understand how these crimes get committed. And that, how that helps us in terms of the profiling, and then helps Gary more in terms of the personality structure.
Right. Well, you have to remember, you're talking about somebody that is enacting a fantasy. I mean, built into it is a kind of dissociative thing, where in that moment, you don't feel like you. You're someone else. You're like a god or a kind of a larger-than-life figure. And that idea of portraying oneself as an alternative figure is very important when we think about the psychology of these people, especially the ones that go out of their way to actually create an alternative persona like BTK or the Zodiac Killer or something like that, where the whole idea is that the self is fragmented, not in the schizophrenic way, but just in a kind of like fantasy versus what I really am kind of way. And I think that the person who committed the Idaho murders would have had fantasies about leveling the playing field against people and dominating them, controlling them in some way. And I think where the ego question comes in is, I think he overestimated the power he could have over people, even if they were asleep, even if they, you know, were vulnerable. I still think someone put up a fight. And don't you think that it does seem one of them put up a fight?
We know they did, because if you look at the affidavit that was just unsealed or unredacted, is the witness in the first floor heard crying several times and was to the point that she went out in the hallway. So someone wasn't killed quickly. So whoever was that, I think it would have been the top floor. Not the first. I think the young man and the young woman were on the.
They were the floor below. The floor below. Yeah, the top floor, I think, was the women who were killed.
Right, and I think he targeted that top floor. Yeah. So and don't forget, that would have been one of the last ones. So he probably getting tired, and that might have been why he couldn't do any more. That's a lot of people with a knife. A gun is very different in terms of needing power, or you know, physical power.
Well, I think it implies someone who wanted some suffering.
It could, yes, yeah.
Right.
It could be the big part, absolutely.
Right. And also, with this kind of personality, there's usually a progression of perversion or sexual thrill that precedes murder. With a lot of these people, we go in and we find out that they've done things like steal underwear, stalk peep and people, things like that. And I would be flabbergasted if we didn't discover a kind of gradual building that preceded. And wouldn't you say, I mean, based on previous offenders, that's very likely.
That's very likely, right. It depends on how sophisticated the fantasy was, how much he had built it up over time. When did he get fired from his job? Was that after? Maybe that was after. I know November was... but those kinds of things, and looking at a timeline, would all be important to look at if you're trying to put this all back together.
Well, I think he would have been getting in trouble and losing a sense of control around the time of the alleged murders. And I suppose what we would hypothesize is that he was using the TA position as an outlet for hostility towards control over other people, particularly women who were allegedly being graded differently and treated differently than males, which is part of what he was getting accused of. And then losing that outlet, you know, became problematic for him.
Right. It'd be important to see what his grades were. Was he flunking? You know, we don't know that. There could have been other pressures coming on, because to lose his TA job, then he lost his financial support.
Oh, that's a great point.
Well, we're going to sleep well tonight. Now, okay. Now, our guests have been two great writers. We've had Dr. Ann Burgess, and we've been talking with her new book, A Killer by Design, and of course, Dr. Gary Brugato, The New Evil. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.